The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 14, Using the Third Eye. One morning, when I was at peace with the world and wondering how to fill an idle half hour before the next service, the Lama Mingyar Dondup came to me. "Let us take a walk," Lobsang. "I have a small job for you to do." I jumped to my feet, glad to be going out with my guide. It did not take us long to get ready, and then we set off. As we were leaving the temple, one of the cats displayed marked affection, and we could not leave him until the roaring purr had stopped and the tail started to wag. This was a huge cat. We called him Cat, in Tibetan, of course, and that was Shimi. Satisfied that his affection was fully reciprocated, he walked solemnly beside us until we were halfway down the mountain. Then apparently he remembered that he had left the jewels unguarded, and off he rushed in a very great hurry. Our temple cats were not for ornament only. They were fierce guardians of the masses of uncut gems strewn around the holy figures. In houses, dogs were the guardians, immense mastiffs who would pull a man down and savage him. These dogs could be cowed and driven off, but not so with the cats. Once they attacked, only death could stop them. They were of the type sometimes named Siamese. Tibet is cold, so these cats were nearly black. In hot countries, so I've been told, they are white, the temperature affecting the fur color. Their eyes were blue, and their hind legs were long, giving them a different appearance when they walked. Their tails were long and whip-like, and their voices. No cat ever had a voice like these. The volume and range of tones was almost beyond belief. On duty, these cats prowled in the temples, silent-footed and alert, like dark shadows of the night. If anyone tried to reach the jewels, which were otherwise unguarded, a cat would emerge and leap at the man's arm. Unless he let go immediately, another cat would jump, perhaps from the holy image, straight at the thief's throat. And these cats had claws twice as long as those of the average cat, and they did not let go. Dogs could be beaten off, or perhaps held or poisoned. Not so with the cats. They would put the fiercest mastiffs to flight. Only men who personally knew these cats could approach them when they were on duty. We sauntered on. Down at the road, we turned right through the Pargo Kaling and walked on past the village of Sho, on over the turquoise bridge, and right again at the house of Doring. This brought us to the side of the old Chinese mission. As we walked, the Lama Mingyar Dondup talked to me. "A Chinese mission has arrived, as I told you. Let us have a look at them and see what they are like." My first impression was a very unfavorable one. Inside the house, the men were pacing about, arrogantly unpacking boxes and cases. They appeared to have enough weapons to supply a small army. Being a small boy, I could investigate in a manner which was quite unsuitable for an older person. I crept through the grounds and silently approached an open window. For a time I stood and watched until one of the men looked up and saw me. He uttered a Chinese oath which threw grave doubts upon my ancestry, but left none whatever about my future. He reached for something, so I withdrew before he could throw it. On the Linkor road again, I said to my guide, "Oh, how their auras turned red, and they wave knives about so." For the rest of the way home, the Lama Mingyar Dondup was thoughtful. After our supper, he said to me, "I have been thinking quite a lot about these Chinese. I am going to suggest to the Precious One that we make use of your special abilities. Do you feel confident that you can watch them through a screen if it could be arranged?" All I could say was, "If you think I can do it, then I can." The next day, I did not see my guide at all, but the following day, he taught me in the morning, and after the midday meal, he said, "We will take a walk this afternoon, Lobsang. Here is a scarf of the first quality, so you do not need to be a clairvoyant to know where we are going. 10 minutes to get yourself ready, and then meet me in my room. I have to go and see the abbot first." Once again, we set off on the precipitous path down the mountainside. We took a shortcut down over the southwest side of our mountain, and after a very short walk, arrived at the Norbu Linga. The Dalai Lama was very fond of this jewel park and spent most of his free time there. The Patala was a beautiful place outside, but inside it was stuffy through insufficient ventilation and too many butter lamps burning for too long. Much butter had been spilled on the floors throughout the years, and it was not a new experience for a dignified lama to pursue his stately way down a sloping ramp, tread on a lump of butter covered in dust, and arrive at the bottom of the ramp with an oop of astonishment as part of his anatomy hit the stone flooring. The Dalai Lama did not wish to risk being the subject of such an unedifying spectacle, so he stayed at the Norbu Linga whenever possible. This jewel park was surrounded by a stone wall some 12 feet high. The park is only about 100 years old. The palace within had golden turrets and consisted of 3 buildings which were used for official and state work. An inner enclosure, which also had a high wall, was used by the Dalai Lama as a pleasure garden. Some people have written that officials were forbidden to enter this enclosure. That definitely is not so. They were forbidden to do any official business within the enclosure. I have been there some 30 times and know it well. It contained a very beautiful artificial lake with 2 islands, upon which there were 2 summer houses. At the northwest corner, a wide stone causeway enabled one to reach the islands and the summer house on each. The Dalai Lama spent much time on one or the other of these islands and spent many hours each day in meditation there. Inside the park there were barracks which housed some 500 men who acted as personal bodyguards. It was to this place that the Lama Mingyar Dondup was taking me. This was my first visit. We walked through the very beautiful land and through an ornamental gateway leading to the inner enclosure. All manner of birds were pecking food from the ground as we entered, and they took no notice of us. We had to get out of their way. The lake was placid, like a highly polished metal mirror. The stone causeway had been newly whitewashed, and we made our way to the farthest island, where the inmost one was sitting in deep meditation. At our approach, he looked up and smiled. We knelt and laid our scarves at his feet, and he told us to sit in front of him. He rang a bell for the buttered tea, without which no Tibetan could carry on the discussion. While we were waiting for it to be brought, he told me of the various animals he had in the park, and promised that I should see them later. With the arrival of the tea and the departure of the Lama attendant, the Dalai Lama looked at me and said, "Our good friend Mingyar tells me that you do not like the auric colors of the Chinese delegation. He says that they have many weapons upon their persons. In all the tests, secret and otherwise, upon your clairvoyance, you have never failed. What is your opinion of these men?" This did not make me happy. I did not like telling others, except the Lama Mingyar Dondup, what I saw in the colors and what they meant to me. In my reasoning, if a person could not see for himself, then he was not meant to know. But how does one say that to the head of a state, particularly to a head who was not clairvoyant? To the Dalai Lama, my reply was, "Honorable, precious protector, I am quite unskilled in the reading of foreign auras. I am unworthy to express an opinion." This did not get me anywhere. The inmost one replied, "As one possessed of special talents, further increased by the ancient arts, it is your duty to say, you have been trained to that end. Now say what you saw." "Honorable, precious protector, these men have evil intentions. The colors of their auras show treachery." That was all I said. The Dalai Lama looked satisfied. "Good. You have repeated it as you told Mingyar. You will conceal yourself behind that screen tomorrow and watch when the Chinese are here. We must be sure. Conceal yourself now, and we will see if you are adequately hidden." I was not, so attendants were called, and the Chinese lions were shifted slightly that I might be entirely concealed. Lamas came in rehearsals as if they were the visiting delegation. They tried hard to locate my hiding place. I caught the thought of one. Ah, promotion for me if I can see him. But he did not get promotion as he was looking on the wrong side. Eventually, the inmost one was satisfied and called me out. He spoke for a few moments and then told us to come again tomorrow, as the Chinese delegation were going to visit him in an attempt to force a treaty upon Tibet. So with that thought before us, we took our leave of the inmost one and wended our way up the Iron Mountain. The following day, at about the 11th hour, we again descended the rocky slope and made our entrance to the inner enclosure. The Dalai Lama smiled upon me and said that I must eat. I was ready for that, before secreting myself. At his order, some very palatable food was brought to the Lama Mingyar Dondup and me. food imported from India in tins. I do not know what they were called. I only know that they were very welcome change from tea, sampa, and turnip. Well fortified, I was able to face the prospect of several hours' immobility more cheerfully. Utter immobility was a simple matter to me, and to all lamas. We had to keep still in order to meditate. From a very early age, from 7 years of age to be precise, I had been taught to sit motionless for hours on end. A lighted butter lamp used to be balanced on my head, and I had to remain in the lotus attitude until the butter was finished. This could be as long as 12 hours, so now 3 or 4 hours imposed no hardship. Directly in front of me, the Dalai Lama sat in the lotus attitude on his throne, 6 feet above the floor. He and I remained motionless. From without the walls came hoarse cries and many exclamations in Chinese. Afterwards, I discovered that the Chinese had had suspicious bulges under their robes, so they had been searched for weapons. Now they were permitted to enter the inner enclosure. We saw them coming, being led in by the household guards, across the causeway and on to the porch of the pavilion. A high lama intoned, "O Mani Padme Om," and the Chinaman, instead of repeating the same mantra as a courtesy, used the Chinese form, "O Mi To Fo," meaning, "Hear us, O Amida Buddha." I thought to myself, "Well, Lobsang, your work is easy. They show their true colors." As I looked at them from my place of concealment, I observed the shimmering of their auras, the opalescent sheen shot with murky red, the turgid swirling of hate-filled thoughts, bands and striations of colors, unpleasant colors, not the clear, pure shades of higher thought, but the unwholesome, contaminated hues of those whose life forces are devoted to materialism and evil doing. They were those of whom we say, "Their speech was fair, but their thoughts were foul." I also watched the Dalai Lama. His colors indicated sadness. Sadness as he remembered the past when he had been to China. All that I saw of the inmost one I liked, the best ruler ever of Tibet. He had a temper, quite a hot one, and then his colors did flash red, but history will record that there was never a better Dalai Lama, one who was utterly devoted to his country. Certainly, I thought of him with very great affection, second only to the Lama Mingyar Dondup, for whom I felt more than affection. But the interview dragged on to its useless end. Useless because these men did not come in friendship, but in enmity. Their one thought was to get their own way, and not be too particular about the methods they employed. They wanted territories. They wanted to guide the policy of Tibet. They wanted gold. This latter had been a lure to them for years past. There are hundreds of tons of gold in Tibet. We regard it as a sacred metal. According to our belief, ground is desecrated when gold is mined, so it is left quite untouched. From certain streams one can pick up nuggets which have been washed down from the mountains. In the Changtang region, I have seen gold on the sides of swift-flowing streams, as sand is seen on the banks of ordinary streams. We melt down some of these nuggets or sand and make temple ornament sacred metal for sacred uses. Even butter lamps are made of gold. Unfortunately, the metal is so soft that ornaments are easily distorted. Tibet is about 8 times the size of the British Isles. Large areas are practically unexplored, but from my own travels with Lama Mingyar Dondup, I know there is gold, silver, and uranium. We have never permitted Western peoples to survey in spite of their fevered attempts because of the old legend, where the men of the West go, there goes war. It should be remembered, when reading of gold trumpets, gold dishes, gold-covered lies, that gold is not a rare metal in Tibet, but a sacred one. Tibet could be one of the great storehouses of the world if mankind would work together in peace instead of so much useless striving for power. One morning, the Lama Mingyar Dondup came in to me where I was copying an old manuscript ready for the carvers. "Lobsang, you will have to leave that for now. The Precious One has sent for us. We have to go to Norbu Linga, and together, unseen, we have to analyze the color of some foreigner from the Western world. You must hurry to get ready. The Precious One wants to see us first. No scarves, no ceremony, only speed." So that was that. I gaped at him for a moment, then jumped to my feet. "A clean robe, Honorable Lama Master, and I am ready." It did not take me long to make myself look passably tidy. Together we set off down the hill on foot. The distance was about 1/2 mile. At the bottom of the mountain, just by the spot where I had fallen and broken my bones, we went over a little bridge and reached the Lingkor Road. This we crossed and reached the gate of the Norbu Linga, or Jewel Park, as it is sometimes translated. The guards were just about to warn us off when they saw that the Lama Mingyar Dondup was with me. Then their attitudes changed completely. We were quickly shown into the inner garden where the Dalai Lama was sitting on a veranda. I felt a little foolish, having no scarf to present and not knowing how to behave without it. The inmost one looked up with a smile. "Oh, sit down, Mingyar. You too, Lobsang. You have certainly hurried." We sat down and waited for him to speak. He meditated for some time, seeming to marshal his thoughts in an orderly array. "Some time ago," he said, "the army of the Red Barbarians, which were the British, invaded our sacred land. I went to India and from thence traveled most extensively. In the year of the Iron Dog, which was 1910, the Chinese invaded us as a direct result of the British invasion. I again went to India, and there I met the man with whom we are to meet today. I say all this for you, Lobsang, for Mingyar was with me. The British made promises, and they were not kept. Now I want to know if this man speaks with one or two tongues. You, Lobsang, will not understand his speech, and so will not be influenced by it. From this lattice screen, you and another will watch unobserved. Your presence will not be known. You will write down your astral color impressions as taught by our guide, who speaks so well of you. Now, show him to his place, Mingyar, for he is more used to you than to me, and, I do believe, he considers the Lama Mingyar donned up to be superior to the Dalai Lama. Behind the lattice screen, I had grown tired of looking about, tired of watching the birds and the waving of branches of the trees. Now and then I took surreptitious nibbles at some sampa which I had with me. Clouds drifted across the sky, and I thought how nice it would be to feel the sway and tremor of a kite beneath me, with the rushing wind whistling through the fabric and thrumming on the rope. Suddenly I jumped, as there was a crash. For a moment I thought I was in a kite and had fallen asleep and out. But no, the gate to the inner garden had been flung open, and golden-robed lamas of the household escorted in a most extraordinary sight. I was hard put to keep silent. I had wanted to explode with laughter. A man, a tall, thin man, white hair, white face, scanty eyebrows, and deep-sunk eyes, quite a hard mouth, but his dress, blue cloth of some sort, with a whole row of knobs down the front, shiny knobs. Apparently some very bad tailor had made the clothes, for the collar was so big that it had to be folded over. It was folded over certain patches on the sides, too. I thought that the Westerners must have some symbolic patches, like those we used in imitation of Buddha. Pockets meant nothing to me in those days, nor did folded collars. In Tibet, those who have no need to do manual work have long sleeves, which completely hide the hands. This man had short sleeves, reaching only to his wrists. Yet he cannot be a laborer, I thought, for his hands look too soft. Perhaps he does not know how to dress. But this poor fellow's robe ended where his legs joined his body. Poor, very poor, I thought. His trousers were too tight in the leg and too long, for the bottoms were turned up. He must feel terrible looking like that in front of the inmost one, I thought. I wonder if someone his size will lend them proper clothes. Then I looked at his feet. Very, very strange. He had some curious black things on them, shiny things, shiny as if they were covered with ice. Not boots of felt, such as we wear, no. I decided that I would never see anything stranger than this. Quite automatically, I was writing down the colors I saw and making notes of my own interpretation of them. Sometimes the man spoke in Tibetan, quite good for a foreigner, then lapsed into the most remarkable collection of sounds that I had never heard. English, as they told me afterwards when I again saw the Dalai Lama. The man amazed me by reaching into one of the patches at his side and bringing out a piece of white cloth. Before my astounded eyes, he put this cloth over his mouth and nose and made it sound like a small trumpet. Some sort of a salute to the precious one, I thought. Salute over, he carefully put away the cloth behind the patch. He fiddled about with other patches and brought out various papers of a type I had not seen before. White, thin, smooth paper, not like ours, which was buff, thick, and rough. How can one possibly write on that, I thought. There is nothing to scrape away. The crayon, things would just slide off. The man took from behind one of his patches a thin stick of painted wood with what looked like soot in the middle. With this he made the strangest squiggles I had ever imagined. I thought he could not write and was just pretending to by making these markings. Soot? Who ever heard of anyone writing with a streak of soot? Just let him blow on it and see the soot fly off. He was obviously a cripple, because he had to sit on a wooden framework which rested on four sticks. He sat down on the frame and let his legs hang over the edge. I thought that his spine must have been damaged, because two more sticks from the frame on which he sat supported it. By now I was feeling really sorry for him. Ill-fitting clothes, inability to write, showing off by blowing a trumpet from his pocket, and now, to make it even stranger, he could not sit properly, but had to have his back supported and his legs dangling. He fidgeted a lot, crossing and uncrossing his legs. At one time, to my horror, he tipped the left foot so that his sole was pointing at the Dalai Lama, a terrible insult if done by a Tibetan, but he soon remembered and uncrossed his legs again. The inmost one did great honor to this man, for he also sat on one of these wooden frames and let his legs hang over. The visitor had a most peculiar name. He was called Female Musical Instrument, and he had two decorations in front of it. Now I should refer to him as Mr. C. A. Bell. By his auric colors, I judged him to be in poor health, most probably caused by living in a climate to which he was not suited. He appeared genuine in his desire to be helpful, but it was obvious from his colors that he was afraid of annoying his government and of having his after-work pension affected. He wanted to take one course, but his government was not willing, so he had to say one thing and hope that his opinions and suggestions would be proven correct by time. We knew a lot about this Mr. Bell. We had all the data, his birth time, and various highlights in his career with which one could plot his course of events. The astrologers discovered that he had previously lived in Tibet and had, during his last life, expressed the wish to reincarnate in the West, in the hope of assisting in an understanding between East and West. I have recently been given to understand that he mentions this in some book that he has written. Certainly, we felt that if he had been able to influence his government in the way he desired, there would have been no communist invasion of my country. However, the forecasts decreed that there would be such an invasion, and the predictions are never wrong. The English government seemed to be very suspicious. They thought that Tibet was making treaties with Russia. This did not suit them. England would not make a treaty with Tibet, nor was she willing for Tibet to make friends with anyone else. Sikkim, Bhutan, anywhere but Tibet, could have treaties, but not Tibet. So the English became hot under their peculiar collars. In an attempt to invade us or strangle us, they did not mind which. This Mr. Bell, who was on the spot, saw that we had no desire to side with any nation. We wanted to stay on our own, to live life in our own way, and keep clear of all dealings with foreigners who, in the past, had brought us nothing but trouble, loss, and hardship. The inmost one was pleased indeed with my remarks after this Mr. Bell had left, but he thought of me in terms of more work. "Yes, yes," he exclaimed, "we must develop you even more, Lobsang. You will find it of the utmost use when you go to the far countries. We will have you given more hypnotic treatment. We must cram in all the knowledge that we can." He reached for his bell and rang for one of his attendants. "Mingyar Dondup, I want him here now," he said. A few minutes later, my guide appeared and made his leisurely way across. Not for anyone would that Lama hurry. And the Dalai Lama knew him as a friend, and so did not try to hasten him. My guide sat beside me, in front of the precious one. An attendant hurried along with more buttered tea and things from India to eat. When we were settled, the Dalai Lama said, "Mingyar, you were correct. He has ability. He can be developed still more, Mingyar, and he must be. Take whatever steps you consider necessary so that he is trained as quickly and as thoroughly as possible. Use any and all of our resources, for, as we have so often warned, evil times will come upon our country, and we must have someone who can compile the record of the ancient arts." So the tempo of my days were increased. Often, from this time, I was sent for in a hurry to interpret the colors of some person, perhaps that of a learned abbot from a far distant lamasery, or a civil leader of some remote province. I became a well-known visitor to the Potala and to the Norbu Linga. In the former, I was able to make use of the telescopes which I so enjoyed, particularly one large astronomical model on a heavy tripod. With this, late at night, I would spend hours watching the moon and the stars. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, and I frequently went into Lhasa City to observe visitors. His own considerable powers of clairvoyance and his wide knowledge of people enabled him to check and develop my own statements. It was most interesting to go to the stall of a trader and hear the man speak loud in praise of his wares and compare them with his thoughts, which to us were not so private. My memory, too, was developed. For long hours I listened to involved passages and then had to say them back. For unknown periods of time, I lay in a hypnotic trance while people read to me passages from our oldest scriptures. End of chapter 14.